G'day, I'm Linda Ross and welcome to the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast. I am thrilled to have this podcast up and running. And really, if you've got any garden questions at all, just head over to the Garden Clinic Facebook page and we can chat about all things gardening over there as well. The
best garden. Hi there, Graham Ross. Now, you all know I love gardening and we all know that sea salt is just simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that sea salt helps with root development? This means that sea salt treated plants have a greater access to water and nutrients in the soil. This goes for everything in your garden, from your lawn to your roses, even your veggie patch. So don't just water your garden, sea salt your garden.
Don't forget the sea salt.
Today I have Miles Baldwin with me. Miles is one of my favourite garden designers in Australia. I think he has an understated elegance that I think belies the vast amount of effort and thought that he puts in his garden designs. His gardens to me have a lived-in sort of connected feeling that they are sort of effortless in a way but earthed into a unique sense of belonging with the home. Miles Baldwin is an award-winning landscape designer and horticulturist. He's designed projects right across Australia and overseas, and he's really able to imbue a sense of unique place in his landscapes. I really welcome Miles to the program. G'day, mate.
G'day. That's all very flattering.
Well, I had to put you in the picture. We met a number of years ago at the Australian Garden Show, and I absolutely loved the little pocket landscapes you made there. They had a real, true, wonderfully earthed feeling. Even though you just put them up in a week ago, it felt like they'd been there for years. How do you really get that sort of antiquity with your landscapes?
Tough one, but like, it's an overall kind of passion for the imperfect, I guess. I'm not a huge fan of that you know, typical nurseryman's tree, and that you find they all grow them in rows, they're upright, they're clipped to that perfect height. I'm usually walking through a nursery and I'm looking for the one that's slightly buggered up, the twisted one, the one that sort of had a tough winter and then spread out a new bit of growth.
And I suppose that's the age and the character that you really easily translate in a landscape, but I find it's absolutely impossible to do when I'm doing it.
Well, just go to the nurseryman, ask for all his knackers.
What made you want to create gardens in the first place?
I can't think of a time when I wasn't. I'd be in the backyard as below the age of 10 building this tiny little thing under next to a pile of dirt. I mean, we had a big pile of dirt in the backyard and it was almost like a BMX track. And I'd be landscaping up the sides of the BMX track with my brothers sort of going, over the top. So there's never a time when I actually wasn't doing it. In fact, when I got my first job at the Royal Botanic Garden, I went in there and I took photos from all the work that I'd done in my parents' house and my aunt's and uncle, all these different projects I did, while secretly gardening back at school, not telling your friends. Yes. They would have referred to it as outside gardening. And then, my little job I had down at Cat's Nursery, which I don't think it sadly exists anymore, down in the Shire. Yeah, so there's never a time I wasn't out there getting my hands dirty.
A lot of kids go into TAFE and do hort, or uni and do landscape architecture. You had a different educational pathway, a rather unique one. Tell us a little bit about it.
Yeah, well, I guess with all my photos and images, I finished off school. I wasn't really planning on doing any university work. I looked around at the time and it was the mid-90s. Everyone's doing these sort of green and white gardens. And I thought, oh, should I do an apprenticeship somewhere? And a year beforehand, I'd gone into the Botanic Gardens and sounded out the idea of perhaps doing an apprenticeship in horticulture at the RBG. Of course, walked in and fell in love with the place and everyone that was working there. And I was lucky enough to be at the time, 280 applicants.
Wow.
I was one of four that actually got in, and that was amazing in itself. And the first place I started there was the government house, to go from being a backyard gardener to getting trained in perennial gardening by a wonderful man called Martin Zierholtz, who knew everything there was to know about perennial. Then finally, working my way around the Botanic Gardens under Jerry Colby-Williams, Frank House at the time, Bruce Rann, all these sort of greats of the industry, building up to Sydney Olympics.
So, yeah, well, you really dived in. You dived in at the deep end.
Yeah.
I suppose starting at Government House, you really got an idea of how that perennial garden, or how that garden full of ancient frangipanis and flax and, formiums and old salvias and things like that, but how that really works in an heritage landscape.
The heritage landscape, but what it gave you is a complete sense of scale. You have these wonderful grandiose views. You have to deal with plants immediately up around the edges of those terraces, and then because everything's so big, everything had to be big against those two. But then you're looking at a landscape that the borders are right there, and then the borders had to increase in their plant material size the further away you looked. And then you had these big shrubbery borders right around the edge of the boundaries. And then, you know, what are these huge big block forms? What are these massive things? I'm standing 400 metres away and I can still see form, shape and structure. And then there's that overall Brownian kind of landscape of the rest of the botanic gardens that's in the background that's been morphed and changed, the trees in the great positions to give you these wonderful views and vistas. And I don't know why, but I kind of sat there and I just kept taking it all in, getting an understanding, I guess, a passion for this Victorian-style horticulture, which I guess then reflects back in all the knacker trees and like by these days.
That's right. And that must have contributed to your overarching design philosophy, really.
Everything being about the plants. You're not going to always be finding yourself in Victorian sort of setting, I guess, but the idea that plants have periods, I found this period design, this period sort of architecture, this period plants, and that can reflect upon all sorts of different ages. You know, there is a modernist plant. There's modern plant aesthetic. There is a very, very common sort of Federation plant aesthetic, and it's something that refers to the now. I could tell you like a good 90s list if you really want.
there'd only be about four plants on it, cordyline, cordyline, and cordyline.
Cordyline, the stylish 90 ones, so the Borough of Iceberg Roses,
The Bucks's Head.
The Bucks's Head and some Megapanthus, yeah.
Your projects have really spanned across New South Wales, Victoria, and overseas, down to Tassie as well. You get these really urban luxe properties in Vaucluse, Neutral Bay, Potts Point and Paddington, but also some rather lovely country properties in Robertson, Southern Highlands and Kangaroon. But every landscape seems to emanate from the era or the heritage of the architecture. And I feel like you are a chameleon in some way because the garden takes on the character and the era of the home. How do you do that?
I do a lot of reading. I do as much travel as I can possibly do to look at gardens. I think I've been to about 7 Chelsea flower shows. spending a lot of time in the Cotswolds. I've got a great friend over in England, and I actually designed a beautiful little garden for her just down in Somerset. This old horticulturist idea of just looking for new and exciting plants. But, yeah, you pick early on the days. I was $200 a week working as an apprentice, so I developed a really great library, actually. I'd save all my money and then I'd go to the Royal Botanic Gardens bookstore. We used to get some good discount. I'd be buying books, you know, Bold Romantic Gardens.
Oh, that was a favourite, Van Omen, Sweden.
Yeah, absolutely stunning book.
I love it.
I even had, you know, one of my first ones is Thai Garden Style. which is a great one. Paul Bangay, or Bangers, he came out with The Box Garden, which I still think is his best book. I reckon that is that the details in there was something that I used to thumb over every kind of weekend, looking at all that little stonework that he did and the layering with the hedging. And I never really had a particular one thing that I liked. I'm hoping that's what allows me to then work in lots of different environments with lots of different architecture.
That's why I think you have a rather chameleon-like quality about you. You can never quite know it's a Miles design because it's so hopelessly attached to the property. I just think it's an extraordinarily beautiful quality that you have, Miles, that not many other garden designers have. But often, that's a Bengay design. It's obvious. Oh, that's a Brendan Moore design. It's obvious. But yours have this real depth to them. I think it's beautiful. I'm a big fan of your work, but as you can hear, but also like I like to get your little updates on Instagram, and I saw the other day that you'd planted 70,000 daffodils in a garden in Tasmania.
Oh, actually that was in the Highlands, that garden.
Oh, was it?
We did that's the initial planting of about 70,000 daffodils. I've since planted another 30,000. We've got a four-year idea that we'll try and put another sort of at least 20,000 per year for the next 4 years.
So. I can just see you come to work that morning. G'day, guys. Right, we're all ready for a big day. We've got 70,000 bulbs to plant. And I want them in threes and fives, thanks.
Threes and fives. No, there's too dense just there. Just a little few more over this one. I need to disperse and then rebuild and then disperse again.
Yes, exactly. I can just hear their eyes roll.
Yeah, everyone looks at me. And I'm usually wearing inappropriate footwear.
Do you prefer to tweak a garden design or do you prefer a blank canvas?
I'm not worried. I like a challenge. If it's a blank canvas and it's too easy, I'd probably get a little bit bored, or I have to make a big statement. It would have to be we're going to build a mountain of bottle trees or something. I don't know. I actually like having some parameters. I like the client coming to me and saying that I just love brown and orange plants.
Yeah, right. This sets you on the path.
Yeah, I like that.
No, brown and orange, that's a challenge for you.
Yeah, actually, I actually use it because I have been given it as a brief before. I'd like a rust-coloured garden.
Rust is great. I think we should define it as rust because orange I find really hard to work with.
It can be. You know, that shock of colour that you get every October, November from Cryvia can sometimes be
that's
a little
right.
bit confronting. But,
that's when I wear my dark sunglasses.
They still have to belong to someone. So if you don't actually have the buy-in from the clients, you don't have the buy-in from the people that are living there, then you're not going to ultimately get these wonderful landscapes and gardens. They just become a statement of myself.
Yeah, and an ego thing for you. And I think that's you've just nailed it. I think that's the secret. I've learned so many things from you, sort of surreptitiously as you've, so I don't know, as we've just talked about things, I've really tried to find out a little bit more about the secret language of design and why certain gardens work. For the layman like us, it's really hard for us to see why a garden design really works and why it doesn't. And I think your parameters and your secrets that you design to, can you just explain your triangulation idea for us?
Yeah, so I guess when we're not looking at a formal landscape, and a lot of people know my gardens from being fairly haphazard in their arrangement and form, we do a lot of formal gardens. In fact, I think we've got probably one of the largest formal gardens in the country down in Geelong. The idea that you would catch plant material in the corner of your eye and you'd be in a concentrated space, and that might be two groupings, one and two, and they could be in the foreground. You'll see them near your right foot and a little bit further away. It's then that jump out to almost like a right-angle triangle, if you imagine where you plant it like that, with two short sides, and then there's a long side, and that next grouping sits further out in the distance. And I always find that as you're walking through a landscape, your peripheral vision would catch this concentration in one corner of the eye, then you'd see that further out in the distance. And the same thing you can then actually repeat in the opposite direction. We can have a larger grouping further in the distance and something sort of small just here on the left. And a lot of those gardens that we do, I guess, appear fairly haphazard, are all based upon this triangulation of groupings of plant material. And you'll see people like Piet doing it with his great perennial landscapes. When I watched his film the other day, and it's good to have a slight bit of vindication.
Yes.
And method in the madness in what he did, and thought, well, he knows what he's doing. I must be halfway on the right track.
Well, yeah, I suppose it's having that sort of matrix or raison d'etre for placing plants in the way that you're placing them, rather than a home gardener sort of just places them all rather haphazardly.
I suppose that repetition
in a triangular way for us in home gardens is a great way of building unity, being brought together.
Yeah, the interesting thing is I had just always done that. I'd never actually considered it before, and it wasn't actually until I started having a design studio and started having staff and I had people working for me that I had to work out how to voice this and how to explain it on the plans so that ultimately I could get everyone on my own team on board. So when we do, I've got an office now with 10 landscape architects working here, and as creative director, I've got to sit down my big pen and you know, lots of scribbles, and then I start doing these markings all over the page, and then the guys here are wonderful on CAD and Photoshop, and they turn my horrible scribbles into something that ultimately I can
present. Pitch and build.
That's it. I must say, they aren't my strong points, being able to do the computer side of things. But I had to explain this, which was really quite difficult.
Look, you've just spoken about your visiting Chelsea Flower Show. I've also had the privilege of going to Chelsea Flower Show numerous times. Those garden designs are, well, they're they're extraordinary. They're built by huge teams of people over a concentrated period of time with a huge amount of money. The budget's massive. so that's sort of the peak of the mountain. But also the Singapore Garden Festival really is the tropical Chelsea, which happens every July. And I'm heading to Singapore Garden Festival. I've been there for the last, well, it's every 2 years, but I always love visiting Singapore in July. Getting out of Sydney winter is one of the great things. But I hear this year that you're creating one of the show gardens for the Singapore Garden Festival. There's about 10 international garden designers that are exhibiting. How did that sort of happen for you?
Yeah, look, we were lucky enough. It's probably about 2 or 3 years back now. We got a best in show and a gold at the Australian Garden Show. That then put us on a certain pedestal, a certain world stage. That we were approached last year to see if we would like to put a design in for the Kingpore Flower Show. So it's an invite-only event, and you would put together a design, and then that design is meted with a lot of other people around the world, and the Singapore government then have a design team that assesses that, and you're then selected into the Singapore Flower Show with nine others. Yeah, we're lucky enough, and we've been partnered up with Nature Landscapes, which is Singapore's largest landscape construction firm, which is really exciting because they've got the infrastructure to do wonderful things. Now, we don't have the budget of Chelsea Flower Show, and this is quite interesting, actually, with the Singapore Flower Show. Everyone's actually on a level playing field because it's all...
They're all given the same budget.
Same budget. It's all sponsored by the one party, which is the Singapore government. And
wonderfully organised, as the Singapore government always is.
They are extremely organised and extremely polite. We've done what we'd like to think is a really interesting design, inspired by, I guess, my interpretation of a colonial Singaporean with a terracotta roof and its white walls and its stone floor, how that we could take, you know, my approach to landscape design and, I guess, a little bit of tropical perennial craftsmanship. And see how we go.
I think Singapore, well, now it's the Singapore Garden Festival has moved, and the backdrop is, of course, Marina Bay Sands, and it's smack bang in the middle of the heart of the Bay Project, which is the Gardens by the Bay. So it's just in this super awesome location now. Back even just a few years ago, it was inside in an exhibition hall. So these days, it's just such a brilliant thing to visit. And I think it's actually visited by more people than Chelsea Flower Show.
Yeah, it is. It's the most visited flower show in the world. And
no pressure, Miles.
That up, they've actually extended it by a few extra days. I think another 5 days, I think, this year.
Well, it is extraordinary because the Singaporeans, of course, being in such tiny little apartments, their love of the landscape and their love of tropical plants is huge. There's a lot of community vegetable gardens, but a lot of balcony gardens and potted plants. But as soon as something's on, of course, they flock to it. And people right across the world come to Singapore in July for the Singapore Garden Festival every second year. So it's an extraordinary event on the gardening calendar. And I look forward to seeing a gold medal on your stand.
No pressure.
Just finally, do you have when you're in the context of the Australian landscape, do you have a favourite palette of plants at the moment?
Yeah, we're looking at native plants. We're looking at different areas.
Let's start there.
I trip around a fair bit in the softer, cool areas. I must say it's not overly native in that as opponents of... I've been doing a lot of really fun things with just green at the moment. In cooler climates, kind of working with Heconochloa and tree ferns and really kind of interesting things like that, trying to juxtapose a lot of shapes and forms. Out in native gardens, I guess I've never really been super strictly native. I bring in a few kiwi plants every now and then and some Mediterranean. So like the olive greens that you might get from an Eleagnus, and then sit that next down to a cushion bush, and then that might kind of work its way through to a West Ginger. So playing with those greys and olive green palettes. We've been doing a little bit of stuff, believe it or not, around Hamilton Islands lately too, which has been interesting and a lot of fun. The world of ginger.
The world of ginger. That Zinsiberaceae family is the largest family of plants in the world.
It is ridiculous. So yeah, we've had so much fun with all that sort of stock at the moment. But then,
in fact, at Singapore Botanic Gardens, they have an extraordinary Zinsiberaceae garden there. With all of the kind of subspecies or subparts of the Zinsiberaceae family. So exciting.
Oh, I went nuts in the nurseries up there trying to find all the beautiful ones to display. But, yes, the world of ginger.
And weirdly, so many of them grow in Sydney.
Yeah, they do. Many of them grow in Sydney. And there's so many different cycads and things too that people don't use. You know, diones and macrozamias and all that sort of zamiaceae sort of stuff is just fantastic. So I'd love to try and put one figure on, say this is all my favourite sort of stuff at the moment, but I guess with the diversity. Actually, just got back from the country too, where we're working Danny Young at the moment. I've gone oak crazy. I think oak's in the Australian landscape, but I love the eucalypts. The eucalypts that sit there and does all the energy to sort of rasp what it can out, extract out of this ground, and then, you know, a few hundred metres away you have a beautiful old oak tree that's just continually dumping material into the ground and supporting this organic community around it.
Absolutely understand. My little house is nestled under the boughs of a 100-year-old pin oak, which is defoliated every winter and just carpets me in a metre of beautiful, you know, kind of scarlet brown leaves, and that I constantly compost. But it's wonderful to feel nestled under the boughs of those oak trees. And there's another big oak with a giant oak leaf, actually. I'm not quite sure the species, but it's a giant oak leaf, kind of like a Quercus robur, but on steroids. It's giant, bigger than my hand.
Yeah. I think there is actually literally a macrophylla species.
Is it?
One of those down in Robertson, the Southern Highlands. Yeah, at the same week of doing the big oak gardens, I'm doing a whole other garden where we're just going to do jacarandas. I put an order in for about 250 jacarandas.
Oh.
And the only thing I'm going to contrast that is with a bit of Ficatilio, macrophylla, some brachychite and rupestris. So,
oh, wow, to get that little trifecta going. How stunning.
Yeah, just to play with those things. Unfortunately, being a plantsman, it's just a bit too hard to find just that one perfect thing.
Well, that's just the joy of plants and the absolute palette that's at our fingertips. It's just like painting with colour and paint. I love your books, The Rural Australian Gardens, The Australian Coastal Gardens was absolutely fantastic, and The Period Gardens, the historic sort of garden book that you did. Is there any more books in the pipeline?
Working away. My business will be 20 years of Miles Baldwin Design coming up in 2020. So I figured I need to do something for that.
Well, congratulations. That's exciting.
Yeah, I just have to sort of find my 20 favourite gardens from the ones that we've done over the years, and which are, you know, it's going to be tough to kind of work through those, but we'll work something out.
Sounds absolutely wonderful. Look, I'll look forward to seeing you in Singapore in a couple of weeks' time. Good luck with the construction. Let's hope it doesn't rain torrential rain like it did 2 years ago.
I'm ready.
You're ready for a monsoon?
I am. I'm the first person who's in the queue, and I've already threatened everyone. I'm just going to basically...
You need the Pope Mobile and just order people from the Pope Mobile so you keep nice and dry.
I'm going to basically have all my construction materials there, which blocks up the rest of the road so no one else can get access. So I've got it all worked out.
Well, good luck with it. I look forward to seeing you in Singapore for the Singapore Garden Festival for 2018. And I look forward to your 2020 book. They're absolutely gorgeous books. If you want to have a look out for them, I'll post it in the show notes for the podcast, and look out for them, well, on Amazon or go to a wonderful bookshop in your area, and I'm sure you'll find them. Thank you so much, Miles, for your time today.
No worries. Talk soon.
Bye for now. I hope you've enjoyed that chat with Miles Baldwin. He's pretty young, you know. It's incredible how many projects he's been able to create in his 20 years in the Miles Baldwin Landscape Design Studio. You know, he's got a one-year-old little boy. I think it's his birthday coming up. Thank you so much for joining us here on the Garden Clinic Digs Deeper podcast. If you like what you hear, don't forget to go to iTunes and give me a 5-star rating. It really helps other gardeners find out what we do on the Garden Clinic podcast. And if you've got a question for me, just head over to the Facebook page and I'll answer it there. It's super easy and it's a nice way to keep connected. Thanks for joining me today. It's been Linda Ross with the Garden Clinic. Happy gardening and go safely.
The best garden in the street.
G'day, Graham Ross here. Now, you all know I love my gardening, and we all know that Sea Sol is simply fantastic for keeping your garden healthy and looking great. But did you know that Sea Sol reduces transplant shock and dramatically increases the plant's survival rate when they're newly planted? Now, look, it's like an insurance policy for your plants. So when you're planting out your seedlings and new plants in your garden, don't just water them in, Sea Sol your plants.
Don't forget the Sea Sol.